Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. We are now living in a period of time that would make a good script for a Shakespearean play. I'm not sure whether it should be a tragedy or a comedy, or maybe a combination of both. On one hand, we have an American election in just a few months, in which there is a possibility that one of the American administrations most friendly to Israel may be removed from office and replaced by administration whose candidate for the presidency has already stated that he is opposed to Israel extending its sovereignty over any part of the area west of the Jordan River, as well as the Jordan Valley itself. And this new Democratic administration will be supported by a Democratic Party whose many influential members have already announced their hostility to the State of Israel. And at the moment, there is a possibility that Israel itself may be heading for another election, which be the fourth one in less than 2 years. So there is uncertainty both here in Israel and its greatest supporter, the United States. And on top of all this, there's a virus that's wreaking havoc both in the United States and Israel. So both the diplomatic and the local political scenes are in turmoil. And the right wing in Israel is pushing for extension of Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley. And the head of the government, Netanyahu, is facing criminal charges. So our most supportive president is facing re-election. And our prime minister is facing criminal charges. And the populations of both the United States and Israel are facing the worst virus since the Spanish flu of 1918. And if that isn't material for a Shakespearean play, I don't know what is. The question is, as I said at the outset, is it a tragedy or is it a comedy? We'll have the answer no later than November, the date of the American election, and maybe even a little bit before that, depending on what happens here in Israel. Thanks for listening. I'll be back after the break.
G'day, I'm Jono Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
New shows are posted every Thursday at 7 p.m. Israel time, highlighting the lighter side and advancing a positive view of Israel here on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
America is our closest ally and our greatest supporter. Therefore, what happens in America affects Israel. I'm afraid that something very frightening is happening in America. Thanks to the coronavirus lockdown, the United States is in a historic upheaval. Small businesses like restaurants and shops that are the lifeblood of cities are shuttered, many for good, leaving signs for rent on street after street in the big cities. Americans huddled in their homes for months on end, believing that if they went outside, that death awaited them. This panic was occasioned by all kind of models they're predicting wildly unlikely fatalities from the coronavirus. These models have already become the basis for the exercise of unprecedented government power. For example, California was the first state to lock down its economy and confine its citizens to their homes. Eventually, almost every other state followed suit under enormous media pressure to do so. Never before had public officials required millions of lawful businesses to shut their doors, throwing tens of millions of people out of work. They did so at the command of one particular group of experts, those in the medical and public health fields, who viewed their mandate as eliminating one particular health risk with every means put at their disposal. If the politicians who followed their advice weighed a greater set of considerations, for example, balancing the potential harm from the virus against the harm from the shutdowns, these leaders showed no sign of it. Instead, governors and mayors started rolling out one emergency decree after another in order to terminate economic activity, seemingly heedless of the consequences. These lockdowns employed arbitrary distinctions. For example, wine stores and dispensaries of drugs, pot, were considered essential and allowed to stay open, while medical offices were required to close. Large grocery stores got the green light to stay open, and small retail establishments where only a few customers a day were closed. It was already clear when these crushing mandates started pouring forth that shutting down every corner of the country was a reckless overreaction. By mid-March, several months ago, health data from Italy showed that the coronavirus was terribly lethal to a very small subset of the population, the elderly infirm, and a minor health problem to nearly everyone else who was not already seriously ill. The median age of coronavirus, people dying in Italy, was 80 years. And they died with a median of nearly three other sicknesses. 3 months later, in June, this profile of coronavirus casualties still holds true. Public health interventions could have been targeted at the highly vulnerable elderly population without forcing the economy of the United States into a terrible death spiral. Now it's impossible to attribute the failure to publicize the facts about the coronavirus as a mere oversight. Every story that does not mention the vast overrepresentation of nursing home deaths in this death count is a story that is deliberately concealing the truth. Casual readers and viewers have been left with the false impression that everyone is equally at risk, and thus that all kind of terrific measures are justified. It seems that the media has been equally uninterested in the scientific evidence regarding outdoor transmission. Coronavirus infections, interestingly enough, require what the Japanese call the three C's: confined spaces, crowded places, and close contact. The short encounters that you have on sidewalks and in public parks, which is what most of city life is, simply do not result in transmission. And yet, if you approach someone on one of the streets, for example, in New York City, the streets, which are, by the way, are pretty much empty, the pedestrians will do all they can to keep out of each other's way. And apparently the public health establishment is equally guilty in creating this ignorance. By the way, we have a friend in Taiwan. We spoke to on the phone on Friday, and she told us that there are less than 100 cases in Taiwan, which is a country with a lot of people. The media and the public health establishment has failed to stress at every opportunity that for the vast majority of the public, the virus is an inconvenience at most. The public health experts did not disclose that outdoors was the safest place to be and people should get out of their homes and into the fresh air. The major problem is, while in America the death toll from the coronavirus has been circumscribed and lower than previous flu pandemics in 1968, 1956, and even in 1918, the economic toll has cut across every sector of the country and every population group. Whole industries have seen their capital wiped out overnight. Despite a better-than-expected employment report in early June, the long-term effects of the shutdowns in America and the continuing mandates to socially distance will prevent a full economic recovery for years to come. Today, 44 million Americans are still out of work. Supply chains have been thrown into chaos. Small businessmen who have put their life savings into creating a service that customers want have seen their hard work go up in smoke. Without rent from retail tenants, commercial landlords can't pay their taxes. City budgets have been decimated. The additional $8 trillion in public debt which has been taken on to try to substitute for the private economy will depress opportunity probably for generations. And the politicians have, I believe, not responded properly. The politicians' ignorance about the complexity of economic life was stunning, as was their hypocrisy. Every elected official, every public health expert, every media pundit who lectured Americans about the need to stay in indefinite lockdown, those people themselves had a secure job which they considered essential. Not one of these experts feared his employer would go bankrupt. Anyone who warned that the effects of the lockdown would be more devastating than anything the virus could inflict was accused of being a heartless capitalist who only cared about profit. But, and this is the bottom line, to care about the economy is to care about life, since the economy is how life is sustained. It is a source of meaning as well as sustenance. It binds humans to each other in a web of voluntary exchange. To its workers, every business is essential, and to many of its customers as well. Even judged by the narrowest possible definition of public health, the toll from these lockdowns will exceed that of the virus due to the cancellation of effective medical procedures, patients' unnecessary fear of seeking medical treatment, and the psychological effects of unemployment. So the United States is in great difficulty because of the way they are handling the virus. And I believe that what happens in the United States will affect the entire world, of course, but mainly looking at it from our viewpoint, it will affect Israel. As I said, America is our closest ally and our greatest supporter. And if America is in difficulty, then obviously we are in difficulty too. That's why I took a few moments now to talk about the coronavirus, because it is really an Israeli topic. Because, as I said, what happens in the U.S. is going to affect Israel greatly. So the coronavirus and the response to it by the leadership in the United States is an Israeli topic and is one which is at the moment very frightening, because what's happening in America is not good, not for America, not for Israel, not for the world. I'll be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On the Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Did you know this psalm and many others were composed by a Jewish shepherd and musician who later became a king? Would you like to know some of the inner meanings of psalms to help you connect with God and strengthen your soul? An exciting and easy-to-read book is now available, which will help you do just that. Software for the Soul, Psalms for Everyone, available on Kindle, Audible, and Amazon.com. Software for the Soul.
Modesty at the beach? It isn't just about body image. It's about feeling good. Modest swimsuits, so we don't get burned by the sun.
So we won't get ogled by strangers.
So we'll feel free to express ourselves without the need to expose ourselves.
Let Marcy Modest help you to cover up what you want, how you want.
Made in Israel.
Visit MarcyModest.com. That's M-A-R-S-E-A Modest.com.
And get a 10% discount on your first purchase.
Two new shows on Israel News Talk Radio.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel?
Shalom, I'm Natalie Zapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. In the previous segment, I spoke about the fact that I'm very worried about what's happening in America, because what happens in America affects the world, and of course it affects Israel. I want to continue just for a few minutes on the same, if you will, pessimistic way. But I think it's realistic, and I think it's important for my listeners to understand what's happening. Within the past 2 weeks, there have been resignations of two powerful Jewish voices. The former New York Times editor and columnist Barry Weiss, which got a lot of publicity, and a former University of Southern California student government vice president named Rose Rich. Weiss and Rich cited outright hostility against the fact that they're Jewish and the fact that they associate or they identify with the State of Israel. And these were the reasons for their decisions to step down from their positions. Now, both of these women, if you check them, you can find them on the internet. They have all the requisite characteristics of progressive people, and they can certainly hold the positions that they were holding. In her resignation letter, the Weiss, which got a lot of publicity 2 weeks ago, she excoriated the hypocrisy she had experienced during her tenure at the New York Times. That was the paper that once advertised all the news that's fit to print and is owned by Jewish ownership. She signals that the lessons about the importance of understanding other Americans, the necessity of resisting tribalism, and the centrality of the free exchange of ideas to democratic society have apparently not been learned. Both Weiss and Rich asserted that it is their respective Jewish identities and their association with the State of Israel that have led to their vilification and forcing them to resign. The critics argue that their support for Israel has rendered them complicit in racism and by consequence guilty of espousing racist ideology. In other words, all you have to do is be a supporter of Israel and you are a racist. In her resignation letter, Rich cites an aggressive social media campaign designed to impeach her Zionism, despite university claims to nurture an environment of mutual respect and tolerance. Similarly, Barry Weiss, who resigned from the New York Times, wrote, and I quote, "Constant bullying by her colleagues who disagree with her views. They have called me a Nazi racist, and they scolded her for writing about the Jews. In addition, several of her colleagues insisted that she be rooted out if the company is to be truly inclusive." The editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal of Greater Los Angeles, a fellow named David Suisa, was quoted by a woman named Lisa Ansel, is a director of the... And a lecturer at Hebrew Language at Hebrew Union College Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. And she quoted Suisa writing that arguably the worst insult in America today is to be called a racist. It is now being weaponized against Jews, of all people, who have the nerve to support the existence of Israel, the Jewish state. There's tremendous irony in this statement and the perils that the current climate of cancel culture, that's the new word now, cancel culture, it cannot be ignored. In an environment in the United States where monuments are being torn down, monuments of Christopher Columbus and President Jackson, all kind of monuments are being torn down. And in the case, buildings are being renamed. The Princeton University renamed a school that had been called the Woodrow Wilson School of, I forget what it was, I think political education, something like that. But anyhow, they removed Woodrow Wilson's name because he was known to be anti-black and anti-Jewish, not violently so, but known to have expressed such feelings. So they're renaming buildings on campuses, and supposedly this is supposed to rewrite the wrongs of the past. But now we have anti-Semitic rhetoric, which really cannot be it cannot be allowed. The attacks on these two women are part of a broader corrosive influence of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, that has permitted the mainstream of progressive consciousness by suggesting that support for Israel, the Jewish homeland, would somehow render a person unfit for office or to justify her impeachment is something that is really frightening. In effect, this resurrects the oldest of the Dreyfus Affair anti-Semitic attacks that call into question the primary loyalties of the Jews who hold public office. I just read a book, by the way, on the Dreyfus Affair with all the details, and it really is frightening. In France at that time was considered to be a very liberal nation, and yet they unjustly found a Jewish officer guilty because he was Jewish. The Jews cannot be held responsible for the actions of the Israeli government, but this is what the anti-Semites seem to do. Somehow every Jew everywhere is responsible for the actions of the Israeli government. Political disagreements have always fueled the fabric of intellectual debate, and especially college campus. College campuses are supposed to be the place where you can express your opinion. So to label Zionism as racism essentially is against all what we knew was supposed to be the job, if you will, of the university. These made people who support Israel fair game to be canceled under the guise of political correctness, and it makes no sense. It makes no logic to what had happened. And what I knew when I was raised and I went to college myself, but this has all changed today, and the colleges are guilty of really reverse racism, if that's the proper word for it. That's as I said, political agreements are what keeps a society healthy, when you can express your opinion and not be afraid that you're going to be lose your job or harmed in any other way because of your opinion. What we are witnessing is a collective silencing of those who don't hold these anti-Semitic views by those who do. This is terrible. Throughout modern history, intellectual curiosity and a sense of civic responsibility is something that's always been looked upon as good, and it's always been something that's developed within the colleges themselves. What we are seeing now, particularly on college campuses and in the press, is a narrowing of the acceptable consciousness. In America, it's called the woke consciousness, where membership is qualified by an asterisk: the Jews need not apply. The United States is at a crossroads with an upending of long-held beliefs, long-held practices, and even social institutions. They're all being questioned, and they're all being redefined to fit the zeitgeist of the current political climate. So it is pretty much incumbent upon those in the responsibility to fight against what's happening. Most of the people are misguided, misinformed, and this is an ideology that has led to the resignation of people from major institutions like the New York Times and like the University of California student government. These are major educational and intellectual institutions. 50 years ago, you could not have imagined what's happening now. And it is a very dangerous time for the United States. And it's something that we have to keep our eyes on, because it's going to affect us in Israel and everywhere. I'll be back after the break.
Leap of Faith with Penina Taylor.
We live in the age of information, but not inspiration. If you're like me, you're looking to be inspired, to reach higher, to connect more, and to grow. Well, if you want to get warm, you need to stand close to the fire. And if you want to catch fire, you need to stand close enough to get hit by the sparks. Join me, Penina Taylor, as we walk with people who have embarked on a spiritual journey towards Torah. We'll uncover what started them on their journey and what truths they discovered along the way. So prepare to be inspired as we take a leap of faith every Sunday at 5 p.m. on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to touch upon a topic now which is approaching a critical period. I'm talking about the annexation of the Jordan Valley or other parts of Judea and Samaria. Late in June, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was asked in Washington about the annexation issue, and his answer was that, and I quote, "Decisions about Israel's extending sovereignty to those places are decisions for the Israelis to make themselves," unquote. So the question arises, what is it? Is the decision to be made in Washington or in Jerusalem by the Americans or the Israelis or by both together? When you ask the question in this manner, the answer would appear to be sort of obvious. The question of applying sovereignty is essentially one of finally settling the borders of the country of Israel, at least the eastern border. Who, other than the state whose boundary is being set, should make that decision? It's obviously, at least in my mind, a decision to be made by the government of Israel. Now, Israel has controlled territories since 1967 in the Six-Day War, and it's acting now as though it cannot decide what to do with those territories. Israel has never decided for itself what it wants to do with Judea and Samaria, partly because Israelis cannot reach a consensus among themselves on this important matter, and also partly because the matter always depends on other factors. It is not a decision made in a vacuum. Regarding the inability to reach a consensus here in Israel, Israelis are no closer now to agreeing on whether it should retain Judea and Samaria. The Israelis are no closer than they were 53 years ago, with some people passionate about the need to keep that area, the West Bank as they call it, and they want to settle it for security and also religious historical reasons, while other Israelis, equally passionate, thinks that it should be ceded and given away in the belief that this will somehow bring the magical peace that we're looking for. So what's the status is that Israel has been unable to decide what to do with Judea and Samaria because always concerned about how the Palestinians will react, what the Arab world will say, what the Europeans will do, what the United Nations thinks, and most of all, what will the Americans allow? And while it is completely legitimate to factor all those considerations into a decision, it's still a decision has to be made. Depending upon other people's position and other people's reaction is not a policy. Israel needs to decide for itself what it wants to do and then go ahead and do it and let the chips fall where they may and dealing with the geopolitical aftermath the best it can. It has to make a decision what is best for Israel and Israel's future. A chronic inability to decide on this matter has over the years been one of Israel's dilemmas in explaining itself to the world. Look at the other side. While the Palestinians have been on a message for decades in saying they want a state based on the 1967 lines with East Jerusalem as their capital, Israel waffles, goes back and forth, and doesn't make a definite statement. One government addresses new settlements and establishes them. Another uproots settlements. One Israeli government freezes settlement construction, and another Israeli government, under a different party configuration, allows settlement to continue. The net result is that the perception is Israel does not know what it wants. And if you don't know what you want, if you never state clearly what you want, then not only are you never going to get what you want, but you also open up yourself to all kinds of pressure from different actors trying to sway your decision one way or the other. If the government, after taking into account all the pros and cons of annexation, if the government believes it is in the country's long-term interest to extend its sovereignty over parts of Judea and Samaria, it should do so as soon as possible, especially now before the American election. This should not be a question of what Israel thinks it can get away with, but rather what it believes it needs for its own vital interests. And just as no government since the Six-Day War back in 1967 has been able to make that important decision, the current Corona emergency government, which has difficulty deciding whether or not gyms should be open during the pandemic, can't decide either what it should do. You have the Likud, you have the Blue and White Party, and as of this week, you even have articles in the newspapers saying that the government might break up and will go to a fourth election within a year and a half. So the question is, what should be done and how soon? So what the government has done, and essentially what Netanyahu said when he said that the issue is now in Washington, he shifted the decision elsewhere, placing it in the hands of the United States, which makes no sense whatsoever. The question of where Israel's eastern border should be is not an American decision, not at all. It is a quintessentially Israeli decision. Jerusalem needs to decide for itself and not parcel out that decision to Washington, regardless of who is sitting in the White House, whether Trump gets reelected in November or whether the Democrats take the White House or perhaps even the Congress or at least part of the Congress The decision about what Israel's eastern border should be is an Israeli decision. No matter, as I said, who is sitting in the White House. If you wait to see who is sitting in the White House and what their response will be, is to abdicate responsibility and to cede, to return our decision-making sovereignty over to someone else. Whether we apply sovereignty or not is probably the most critical issue that has come up since the Six-Day War. The most critical. And it's quite a paradox when what is on the table is whether to extend even further the country's territorial sovereignty and make it dependent upon how others are going to respond or who is in the White House. This is an Israeli and a purely Israeli decision, and in whatever direction Israel goes, it must be prepared to handle the responses from the European Union, from the United Nations, from the other Arab countries. The bottom line is, it is a decision that can be not be put in anyone else's hands. And once making the decision, be prepared to handle the responses from all around the world. This is all further complicated by the fact that Israel is in a really tight situation, because unless a budget is passed by August 25th, the country, according to the rules of procedure, will be forced to head to a fourth election. And the moment the government falls, the entire issue of annexation in any meaningful way, the whole question ends, unless U.S. President Donald Trump wins the November election. So right now, we are in a very short opening. It's not just between now and the U.S. election, but between now and August 25th, which is just around the corner. Otherwise, the government is going to fall. So, they could symbolically pass an annexation during the election period, but it would be meaningless unless ratified by the new government. So, and that ratification could not occur perhaps till 2021. So right now, we are in a very tight situation in which the government must make a historical decision. That is the place we are in right now. Till next time, take care of yourself. Jay Shapiro signing off.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem.
I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Duff from Malajamim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.